How does getting older affect your writing or your philosophy on life?
Well, I think I'm a guy who matured pretty late. Well, I don't want to say that. I'm not. I got older. I didn't mature. But you know, the one thing young people don't know, and will never know, is what it's like to be old.
Yeah.
You look different, and so they think you are different. Mm-hmm. But you just look different. You're the same, you know, 23, 29, 37, whatever you are inside. You're the same guy, but you look different. They think you're different. I do think it takes a while for, you know, a writer to... I don't know about other writers. I know that for me, it took a long time I don't even know what to say exactly. You know, I've changed from book to book. Almost always, each book was considerably different than the previous mm-hmm. one. And in part, that was just, you know, waiting for another forum that would express content in a new way. But along the way, I think, you know, there's a certain... I mean, once you get old enough, of course, you don't give a damn what others think. Mm-hmm. And that's important. You know, you start out with a lot of nerve because you feel you're... I mean, most... I don't know about everybody, but I and a lot of the people I knew when I started writing, we felt we were experimental. Yeah. We certainly wanted to be experimental. We wanted to be avant-garde. We were happy to be thought outsiders. Mm-hmm. And so we had nerve. But nerve isn't the same thing as confidence. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, there's a point at which you are what you are, and you are wholly what you are, wholly what you are. And... in a way, you're not thinking about what others think. Don't forget, I grew up in the 50s, and in the 50s, that's all people thought about, is what other people thought of them.
No.
And if I hadn't gone to college, and people didn't go to college where I grew up, but my father, even though he was an immigrant from Ukraine with no education, mm-hmm. he thought it's a good idea if I went to college. Mm-hmm. So I went to a little school in upstate New York called Alfred University, which is in Alfred, New York. Which is down the road from Alfred Station.
Okay.
About 60 miles south of Rochester. Mm-hmm. And within the private university called Alfred is a State College of Ceramics. And within the State College of Ceramics is a design department meant to turn out ceramic designers. But in fact, it turns out people like my friends Frank and Carol DeGangi, who are coming in a few days to visit, it turns out these wonderful artists, because... all these kids down in New York City and elsewhere realized, whoa, I can go to this design department. I get to take all of the art courses I want. And the design department had this wonderful, freaky arts faculty. There's a reason why these people would come there, but they were there. And there was no tuition for years in state schools. No. And then it was very reasonable, $200, $250 yeah. bucks.
Yeah.
So the design department was a bunch of freaks. There were all these artists. I'd never seen that. I'd never seen people who, because they had work to do, didn't care what other people thought of them. Mm. This was a time when, you know, you better join a fraternity or you have no social life. Mm-hmm. Or a sorority, you have no social life mm-hmm. otherwise. These people didn't care about that at all. They had work to do. And I would take long walks, I still do. I would take walks in the middle, you know, it'd be 30 below, and they'd see my footprints in the snow, they'd know it was me. And I could always go down to the design department because the students would be down there at 3 in the morning making lithographs and painting and doing whatever they were doing with the radio playing and pizza. The janitor gave up trying to lock the building because they'd break in. And that was an education for me. And so I started hanging around with those people. I did a lot of journalism. I did for a long time, I did what we used to call creative photography to distinguish it from photojournalism. And I had been playing cornet since I was even shorter than I am now, and had played a lot of serious music for a long, long time. But gradually I started hanging around with people who also wrote, did all this other stuff, mm-hmm. you know. And that was an education for me, for a kid from a small town where people didn't go to college, seeing people who had work to do, work that influenced their whole day and their whole attitude, was a revelation.
So you started writing, actually, in college after?
Except for journalism, I didn't write until after college. Let's see, I went up to graduate journalism school in Syracuse. Mm-hmm. And I spent one semester there. And then I ended up in Rochester for a short time, and then in Chicago.
Yeah.
And in Chicago, I was taking a very slow MA and working at the law library. And I had done my courses. I had to be enrolled in something in order to take my MA exam. Now, I was already writing poems that at best could be called wordplay. And I was even publishing a literary magazine with friends from Rochester. It was literary and visual materials both, and it was called Statements. Mm-hmm. And it was a nice little magazine, actually, and it published some people who later became pretty well known. And but, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I hadn't read much contemporary poetry. All I really knew were the beats. My first wife and I and a good friend of mine who now lives in Seattle used to skip classes and go to an Italian restaurant called the Italian Villa. And we would have antipasto salad for lunch and pizza for dinner, and we would read the beats to each other. You know, that seemed, the beats, that must be real, you know. Mm-hmm. So there I was in Chicago. I needed to take a class. I took a class in the downtown center of the University of Chicago, taught by some guy named John Logan, poet. Mm-hmm. I didn't know who he was. He was actually a real poet. He had published one book of poetry. He would later publish many more and become very well known. Mm-hmm. But he had published one book of poetry called Cycle for Mother Cabrini. He was teaching at Notre Dame. He had converted to Catholicism years before. He had 9 children, a parrot and a dog. I took that class, and Dorothy, who's I had a short marriage before this. Dorothy's actually my second wife. Dorothy and I took this class. And we got to be pretty good friends with John. We went out to his home in South Bend. We met his wife, Gwen. And he came over to our little apartment and had some spaghetti with us. And we had a son. I had a son by my first wife, and I kept him when we broke up. So we had this little tiny baby. We weren't married, but we had this little tiny baby. And then one day after class, John and Dorothy and I, and Bob and Dorothy Jungles, who were very close friends of the Logans, we were in a bar having a beer. And John Logan had converted to Catholicism. He did not curse. He hardly ever took a drink. He did not drive. He rode the bus into class. Mm. And he suddenly turned to me and said, "By the way, when's your anniversary?" And I thought, I can't tell this man. And we're not married, you know. Nice people didn't do that then. We have this child. So I said, "July 9th. And he said, "That's my anniversary." It was theirs. It was his. And it was the Jungles' anniversary, who had done it deliberately, you know. Yeah. So when Dorothy and I did get married, we felt we had to get married on July 9th. You bet.
That's wonderful.
What question was I answering?
When he started writing.
Oh, yeah. So I started writing a lot more in that class. And another member of that class was Dennis Schmitz, who's one of the wonderful poets in this country, I think. And then when the class was over, John asked me if I wanted to be part of something called the Poetry Seminar, which was not a class, but a group of Chicago poets that included people like Dennis Schmitz and Bill Knott. And Charles Simic came through it for a while. Naomi Lazard, other poets whose names you might not know now, Roger Aplin, William Hunt, other people. And I said, sure. And so we would meet periodically. I can't remember anymore if it was once a month or twice a month. We would meet in the downtown Chicago offices of the Midwest Clipping Association. Because mm-hmm. in those days, you know, people, politicians and so forth, would pay somebody to subscribe to newspapers and mm-hmm. clip out articles about them. Well, we would meet then. So now I was writing more. Mm-hmm. And then I had an old commission. I was stalling the Army. What am I going to do? I want to find out if I can write. I want to do more of this. I said to John Logan, "What should I do?" And he said, "Well, there's this workshop in Iowa City. A poet there named Donald Justice, I'll write him a letter. And why don't you try to go there?" And I could keep the Army at bay if I faked being a PhD student. Mm-hmm. So I went to Iowa City for an interview. And I had a professor at the University of Chicago who taught Henry James. His name was Napier Wilt. And he kind of looked like Henry James, actually. And he used to talk about where he came from. He came from some place that was really rural. I mean, primitive. And the pigs would come right up to the porch, he said. And that place was Iowa City, Iowa. So when it was time for me to go be interviewed in Iowa City, Iowa, I thought, I'm not going to drive out there. That's the wilds. I'll take a bus. So I took a bus, and I followed people into a building, and I had been told to stay at the Berkeley Hotel. I said, can you tell me where the Berkeley Hotel is, to a man behind a counter? He said, this is it. So I took a room. I got in the morning. I said, excuse me, can you tell me where the University of Iowa is? He pointed across the street. He said, that's it. So I went to the interview. I put on a tie, you know, and I went to the union to meet Donald Justice and for my interview. And after about 5 minutes, Kim Merker, who was the Stonewall Press and later the Wendover Press too, Kim Merker came along and we went bowling. And I always figured I must have bowled okay because I got accepted. And I stayed 3 years before I had to go in the Army. And there, you know, John Logan was a wonderful teacher because he took our content seriously no matter how sophomoric it was. And he read beautifully so that when he read, when he read our poems aloud, we thought we were good, you know. So that was he was a great teacher for a beginning poet. And Donald Justice was a great teacher in another way because he was very, very precise. A formalist at heart, but welcoming to all styles and very precise in his analysis. And the students there were all outsiders of, you know, who had found their way to this program circuitously because there weren't a lot of MFA programs then. In fact, there might have only been one or two others. And so that was another thing I wrote. I would turn three poems a week in. I would write more than three, but I would put three in an envelope and turn them in. And again, I think the biggest element was wordplay. Mm-hmm. It turns out that wordplay is a good sign of a young poet, but I didn't know that. It was just what I could do. Mm-hmm. And gradually, I realized that no, this, you know, there was something beyond this. And I actually just changed my way of writing one day and started over, and one thing led to another. I kept on writing while I was in the Army, and you know, kept on. Mm-hmm. People who write for a semester or you know, a college year or even a college, even 4 years of college, are doing one thing, but people who write for 10, 20, 30 years are doing something else. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go on writing for 20, 30 years, it's because you're getting something out of it. You need to do it. And it's true. No matter what, you know, the literary world is full of insult. Put yourself out in the public, you're going to get some negative stuff. But writing just feels wonderful. I mean, I love the discovery aspect of writing. I love that. I love not knowing what I, you know, saying what I didn't know I knew, not knowing where I'm headed, letting the materials, abandoning myself to materials and figuring out where I'm going. Of course your personality is going to come out. Of course your obsessions will make themselves known. Of course, if you're of a philosophic mind, a matrix of philosophy will be behind things. Everyone has a stance, an attitude, a vision, a viewpoint. All that will come out. But in the meantime, you know, you're just dog paddling like mad. And that's fun. That's what I always liked about every art, you know.
There was a writer who won the Nobel Prize, and he was first contacted by a journalist who said, you know, what do you think about having won the Nobel Prize? And the writer said, well, I don't know. I haven't written about it yet.
That's good.
So
that's good. Yeah.
That you would.
Yeah. Someone is supposed to have confronted E.M. Forster at a writer's conference and said, how do I know what I mean until I see what I say?
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thrill of it. Now, I know there are people who write, and even Yeats would sometimes take an idea, a prosaic prose idea, and just labor it over a long period into poetry. A poet named Hollis Summers, who was from Ohio, no longer with us, used to write out ideas and poeticize them. I could never do that. I have to be in the midst of the energy.
Yeah.
But there are, you know, there are lots of different ways to write.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that people who believe they're going to push an idea that they have from the beginning are better off writing in meter and rhyme. I think formalist forms work better for that.
Mm-hmm.
But free verse is another kettle of fish. Free verse is not a form. It's a method for finding new forms. There are all kinds of free verse. And to, you know, if you're revising a poem written in meter and rhyme, you can usually see where it's broken. You can look at it. It's like a good machine, and you can see where it's broken, and you can try to fix that part that's broken. But in free verse, that's a different business. You have to get back into the energy of that poem. You have to get back into the energy of the steps that that poem takes from beginning mm-hmm. to end. And you can't always do that. Mm-hmm. So I think free verse, my gut feeling is that free verse poets abandon more than formalist poets do. I know that I abandon a lot. I've worked out a way of writing over the years that allows me to stay in the energy, but if the energy flags, I get up and walk away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'll come back to it and try to get back into it. I can't always do that, which means I lose a lot.
Yeah. Why do you think that, I mean, meter and rhyme, not very much is written in that, and hasn't been for many years. What?
Not as much as used to be. I mean, there still are plenty around, but you know, I mean, when I started writing, meter and rhyme was still the coin of the age. Mm. There were plenty of people writing free verse, but it wasn't the main thing, and so it was still interesting because it existed in contradistinction to mm-hmm. formalist verse. And I can still remember Don Justice, my friend and later colleague mm-hmm. And teacher. I can still remember a worksheet. I had a poem on a worksheet 1 week in free verse, you know, and he kind of raised his eyebrow and said, "This poem appears to be written in free verse." And I said, "Oh no, it's written in sprung accentuals with variant lines." You know, you had to know. I mean, I know meter, and you had to know meter. You had to be able to talk the talk of the matricians mm-hmm. so that they would know you were serious.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's happened, of course, is that free verse has become the coin of the age. And that's why I say in those 32 statements about writing poetry is that every free verse poet needs to reinvent free verse for himself or herself.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, there's no energy in the language. There isn't as much formalist verse being written now. I mean, there's still some around. There are a bunch of younger poets, I guess they're no longer young, but younger poets, who tried to start a whole school of it at one point. Mm-hmm. They were quite mean about anybody who didn't write in rhyme and meter. The problem was they weren't that good at it.
Mm.
They depended on a narrative, and the narratives weren't that exciting. Plus, you know, we don't sit still for narratives very much anymore. Mm-hmm. We're into jump cuts, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they weren't that good. I remember turning to Don Justice once, who was a very skillful formalist and an innovator in forms. I remember turning to him one day and saying, "Are these guys any good?" And he said, "Oh, no." You know, he was their hero, too. Mm-hmm. But he said, "Oh, no." But when they're good, they're good. I mean, early James Merrill, Richard Wilbur, Donald Justice, Anthony Hecht, Howard Nemirov, you know, there are people who were terrific, but you're absolutely right, there isn't that much of it now. But there are some people who can really do it. Gertrude Schnakenberg is very good, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are others. Mm-hmm. There are many others, mm-hmm. You know.
Well, you know, we seem to be in the age of the soundbite now. We want things very, very short. Does that affect the poetry writing?
Well, Edgar Allan Poe made a remark that's quoted a lot of times. He said, "A long poem is a contradiction in terms."
Hmm.
But what he meant by that is that the energy can't sag. It has mm-hmm. to go by, you know, fast. Now, actually, people who write book-length poems will tell you that there have to be places that relax in them.
Yes.
You have to allow the reader to relax.
Yes.
But that was Poe's idea, and I guess it's come true with a vengeance, because we are a soundbite community. And the lyric poem, now, some people, there have been poet critics who have said, "Oh, the lyric is dead," and they've been mean toward what they call a lyric, but they don't understand the notion of lyric. I prefer Aristotle's distinctions. There's lyric, epic, and dramatic. Dramatic is spoken from the stage, Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
Epic poetry tells a long story, Beowulf.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is lyric.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Lyric poetry normally won't be that long, of course. A sonnet is not too long for us. But it is true. You know, we don't know how sophisticated we are. We don't realize how sophisticated we are. When I was a kid, we'd go to the movies at any time of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't matter when the movie started. We just go to the movies. You want to go to the movies? Yeah, we go to the movies. You walk in. Okay, if there was 15 minutes to go, we'd wait 15 minutes. But if there was an hour to go, no. Walk right in. Turn around to somebody behind you and say, "What's going on?" In about three sentences, you were caught up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if there was a jump cut, if they were riding on the range and now they were in the kitchen, half the audience would turn to the other half and say, "What happened?"
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are so sophisticated now. We have movies like Run, Lola, Run. and Memento. These are movies that just go, you know.
Yes.
And people watch CNN, and there's, you know, there's something on the left side, and there's a crawl underneath it, and you go to an internet page, and you got seven things competing for your attention. It's nuts. I mean, some people think the human brain is evolving. I doubt it. I don't know. Maybe our eyes are evolving. I don't know what's happening. You know, Will and Ariel Durant, those great historians, they wrote all these books about this and that aspect of history. And then they wrote a thin book called The Lessons of History, in which they took up different aspects of history, economics, political systems, and so forth, just in a short essay. And basically, they wanted to trace each element and ask the question, how has mankind changed? And what they concluded was that mankind, in all of these years on Earth, had evolved very slightly, if at all. Negligibly, if at all. And yet, when you read what's going on in science, you can't help thinking that something's going to happen if we don't blow up the world, we don't run out of every resource there is. Because they claim that, for one thing, they claim that they will be able to put what they call robots, so they don't look like any robots you and I picture, they'll be able to put robots into your brain, which will basically download all the information from your brain and then upload a whole lot more. And the way they put it is, mankind at that time will stand in relation to us as we do to the ants.
Well,
I read something fairly recently in which they claimed that with continuing progress in miniaturization and memory expansion for computer chips, there will come a time when, let's say you're boarding an airplane and you intend to do some work. This is going to sound so crazy when I say it that I almost don't want to say it. You will download the internet. You will download the entire internet. I don't know what that means, but you will download so much information. And I've like to say in conversation, you know, just for fun, that I believe, and I really do believe this, that if we don't blow up the world or use it up, that there'll come a day when people will live forever. I really believe that. Yeah. I think they will grow and manufacture, and I think there's a third way, I can't remember how, every part there is, and that the supercomputers will succeed in mapping the brain. And I like to go on and say people will wonder what it was like to have been dead.
That's a very interesting concept. Sure. Yeah.
I honestly believe this is conceivable.
Oh, I think anything is possible. Anything. And that certainly is possible, absolutely.
Yeah. I know it sounds nuts. Now, I'll have to tell you about another of my crazy ideas, though, because it involves a story. So we're sitting around having dinner with some friends not long ago, and something comes up that makes this relevant, I don't know, and I say to him, well, you know, I don't believe in time. I said, I don't know why I don't believe in time. I once did, but I didn't write it down. But I know that I don't actually believe in time. So one of the people at the table says, well, you know, Stephen Hawking doesn't believe in time. Oh, so now I was really impressed with myself that a great physicist agreed with me.
Yes.
Whereupon Dorothy looked at me with what in Hawaii they call the stink eye and said, I gave you the book.